KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Question: what do Donald Rumsfeld and Larry Summers, the former president of Harvard and Clinton administration official, have in common? Answer: neither are entirely welcome on the campuses of two Bay Area universities. Summers was just disinvited as a dinner speaker for the University of California Board of Regents, and Rumsfeld has kicked up a petition drive protesting his recent appointment as a fellow at the Hoover Institution on the campus of Stanford University. Throw in today's news about the president of Iran speaking at Columbia and the ongoing controversy surrounding the hiring of a law school dean at UC Irvine, and you start wondering what's going on in academia. We'll take up that question next on Forum after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Larry Summers went from being Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary to the presidency at Harvard. Life hasn't been the same for him since. He left Harvard in part because of a controversy surrounding his suggestion that researchers should look into whether gender differences in the human brain might explain why more men pursued scientific careers than women. That was 2 years ago, but this week Summers was disinvited as the featured dinner speaker at a University of California Regents dinner because his prior remarks offended a number of UC faculty members. Donald Rumsfeld may also be walking into unwelcome waters, this time on the campus of Stanford University. The independent Hoover Institution there has awarded Rumsfeld with an appointment, and numerous Stanford faculty are protesting. There's also the curious saga of Edward Chemerinsky, a distinguished and outspokenly liberal legal scholar who, over the past 2 weeks, was first hired as dean of the new University of California Irvine Law School, then had that appointment rescinded, and then was rehired. And last, away from the Bay Area, there's today's debate over whether or not the president of Iran should be allowed to speak at Columbia University. So are there some views that are so divisive they just should not be expressed on a university campus? Are there some people who, because of their past or their point of view, should not be hired? If so, where do you draw those lines? And what might those lines portend for the future of academic freedom? Joining us to talk about this morning, John Eastman, a constitutional scholar and dean of the Chapman University School of Law. He joins us this morning from Orange, California. Dean Eastman, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Pleasure to have you with us. Philip Zimbardo is professor emeritus of psychology at Stanford University and has led the petition drive opposing Donald Rumsfeld's appointment at the Hoover Institution. Professor Zimbardo, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Happy to have you join us. Thomas Lifson is joining us as well. He's editor and publisher of The American Thinker and author of The New McCarthyism at the University of California. Mr. Lifson, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And Greg Lukianoff is with us as well. He's a First Amendment attorney and president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He joins us this morning from Washington, D.C. Mr. Lukianoff, good morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks all for being with us. These are interesting cases and all different in particular ways, but we also want to pose the question this morning about whether or not there's sort of a common thread that unites these different instances that are now going on at various university campuses. John Eastman, let's talk first about this question of who's allowed to speak and differentiate that a bit from the question of who you hire. So in terms of who's allowed to speak and the case of Larry Summers, for example, being disinvited from a UC Board of Regents dinner, what's your view on what that decision suggests?
Well, I do think there is a line that needs to be drawn. You don't want to invite, for example, a former member of Hitler's cabinet to come speak at a public event for your university in a way that makes it appear as if you embrace or condone the behavior. If you're going to have such a speaker, it ought to be in a context of a forum that would allow for intellectual discussion, and the competing, correct point of view to come out. So I think there's a difference between a keynote speaker where that's the only view being portrayed and therefore somehow has the endorsement of the university, and an intellectual exchange. And then even with the latter, intellectual exchange, there quite frankly need to be some views that are just not part of common discourse. And I would think support of genocide, for example, would be one of them.
So, now, for example, in the Columbia case where Ahmadinejad is going to be part of that sort of intellectual pro and con and back and forth, you would still have questions about that because of some of the views he's espoused?
I would. You know, I mean, I think if you're going to have a forum for free speech, we ought to set a standard that people participating in that forum ought to have views shy of saying your opponent has to be destroyed and thrown into the sea. And that seems to be a good place, at least a starting place, for where we draw a line.
Phil Zimbardo, why don't you hop in then on the question of speaking, looking again at the case of Larry Summers, on the one hand, the former distinguished Secretary of the Treasury and Harvard president, but has espoused views that some find offensive. Now we have the case of the president of Iran speaking at Columbia. Where do you draw that line about who should be allowed to just speak on campus?
Well, see, for me, there are several issues that are entwined. All academics believe in free speech. That is, you know, we don't want to create the new McCarthyism, which suppressed academic discourse for almost a decade. I think, as Greg said, when it's in the context of open discussion, debate, challenge, multiple points of view, you know, we applaud that. I am one of the faculty members leading the charge against the Hoover Institute making an appointment to Donald Rumsfeld as, in quote, a distinguished visiting fellow to the Hoover Institute. My opposition and that of more than 2,000 faculty, students, alumni, and that number will swell as soon as school is back in session, is based on the fact that he has not distinguished himself in any way that is acceptable mm-hmm. to the majority of faculty. He said to the Armed Service Committee that the abuses at Abu Ghraib occurred on my shift as Secretary of Defense, and therefore I am fully responsible. That's almost a quote. Not only was he not responsible, but the policies that he put in place in Guantanamo that migrated to Abu Ghraib were instrumental in causing those abuses. Soldiers went to prison, and he got a distinguished an award.
Let me interject, if I might, Professor Zimbardo, because I want to come back to the question of hiring, both with because that's in a sense what's in play with Rumsfeld, but just on the question if he were invited to speak at Stanford University, setting aside the question of his being appointed a distinguished scholar at the right. Hoover Institution, would you object to Don Rumsfeld coming and speaking?
Oh,
at Stanford?
Not at all. I would love to debate with him. Obviously, that you know. But the other problem is the Hoover Institute is separate from Stanford, except it gets its publicity by saying Stanford University's Hoover Institute. And so it appears as if his appointment has gone through a Senate, you know, faculty committee, when it hasn't. It's a board of overseers. And obviously the Hoover Institute is very conservative, and that's a nice balance on the campus.
Well, let's come back, if we might, to this question of hiring in a moment, but I want to get our other guests involved, just if we can, to focus on this question of who's welcome to simply speak, be that Larry Summers or be that the president of Iran. Thomas Lifson at the American Thinker, chime in on that point. Thomas Lifson, are you with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, please.
Okay. I'm very reluctant to disinvite anyone, and on that grounds, even though I deplore and detest President Ahmadinejad, I don't think he ought to be disinvited, even though he is a monster. And I'm shocked to hear Professor Zimbardo trying to anathemize a former defense secretary of the United States. People can legitimately disagree on whether his tenure as defense secretary was a good thing or a bad thing, but to anathemize him from presence at Stanford, not for a career, but as a visiting fellow at a part of the university known as the Hoover Institution, not the Hoover Institute, is horrific to me.
But Professor Zimbardo said that he thought that it would be fine to have Don Rumsfeld come and speak. His point of departure was on whether or not he should be hired by the Hoover Institution for a year-long scholar position.
Yes, and he's going to be there for a temporary period. He's going to do research and other sorts of work that requires more than one speech. And I don't think that he ought to be hounded off the campus. I think that's a bad thing.
All right, Phil Zimbardo, go ahead briefly, and then I want to get to Greg
Lukianoff. Nobody's hounding him off the campus. We are protesting the appointment. Hoover Institution is going to go through with it. You know, we are simply protesting the fact that he is being given a distinguished label for what he did in Iraq, what he did in Abu Ghraib, is anything but distinguished.
So your point is you want to make that point. You want to register a question of disapproval. It's not that you're trying to bar him from campus?
No, not at all. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is not a fascist state. The Hoover Institute, since it's independent, can do anything it wants, and certainly it's not going to rescind his appointment. We would hope he would reconsider that whether his time would be better spent somewhere else. But the point is that, you know, we want to hear his opinion. We don't want him seen as a Stanford University visiting fellow.
All right, let me hear from Greg Lukianoff on this point now, too. And coming back to what Dean John Eastman of the Chapman School of Law said at the beginning, which is it's possible to draw lines. The line for him, mm-hmm. which should not be crossed, is someone like President Ahmadinejad, who has denied that the Holocaust exists, thinks that Israel should be destroyed, that's to a point where that view really is not welcome on campus. Where do you draw the line?
Well, I have precious little trust of universities' abilities to draw these lines. I've been doing this for 6 years, and I have seen people get in trouble for the most absurdly tame, relatively mainstream points of view. And overall, as a free speech group, I think this actually has some, this anecdote has some relationship to what we're talking about here. I was on Hannity and Combs, and I was defending the right of a
the
group
program
of
on Fox, the Fox network.
Right.
Yeah.
I was defending the right of a group of college Republicans to protest the fact that Ward Churchill was going to speak on campus. Hannity and Combs practically, they could not wrap their brains around the idea that when they asked me whose side I was on, whether I was on Ward Churchill's or not.
What and remind us, please, Greg Lukianoff, of Ward Churchill's case.
Ward Churchill is the former professor out in Colorado,
right.
who said that that the victims of 9/11 and the World Trade Center had it coming essentially because they were, quote unquote, little Eichmanns. They were part of a genocidal machine, and therefore they got what was coming to them. Now, what they couldn't seem to wrap their head around was the fact that I had quite publicly defended Ward Churchill's free speech rights, but we're also defending the right to protest his speaking there. So both rights are protected. Our overall preference, though, is that people are invited, that discussions are had, even with people that you think are horrifying, have horrifying opinions, and see how they stand up to the light of day. That's the great and in some ways crazy and wonderful principle of a university, sort of a chaotic paradise where even the most extreme arguments can be made and debated.
And is that sense, John Eastman, of what the university is somehow less secure right now? What's behind, do you think, this greater concern, this greater sort of cautionary view, this sense that we don't necessarily want to hear every point of view?
Well, first let me I don't think this is anything new. The notion of universities trying in their search for truth to say that there are certain views that are just so horrendous and so anathema to that search for truth that we're right in blocking that because it infects the overall mission of the institution. What I'm finding troubling is the inconsistent application of that old rule.
Mm.
The notion that Don Rumsfeld, ought not to be with a distinguished visitor. He was Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, for example, and a distinguished career. But that it's okay to have Ahmadinejad up on Columbia without a counter point of view. There is a hypocrisy in
right.
those two cases. And you throw in the Erwin Chemerinsky case on top of the Don Rumsfeld thing. I mean, Erwin's got views as far to the left as Don Rumsfeld has to the right. And there was this hue and cry across the land, but from conservatives as well as liberals about Erwin's firing. Mm-hmm. But conservatives coming to the defense of Don Rumsfeld doesn't find the partnering with liberals in that context. It's the hypocrisy of that I think is the most troubling aspect of all this.
Right.
Today.
And can I add something to that about the Columbia situation?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Who is this, please?
Oh, this is Greg Lukianoff.
Go ahead, Greg.
And it is interesting. I mean, Columbia was rightly called to the mat for a double standard. You might remember that there was a mini riot last year during a speech by Jim Gilchrist, the head of the Minutemen, the people who self-police the border, and that event was essentially shut down by students rushing the stage. The university initially decided to reinvite Gilchrist in order to have that discussion that they never really got to have, but then uninvited him virtually at the same time they were inviting the president of Iran. So this double standard is really striking. And, of course, in my opinion, both should be invited, both should be heard, and both should be debated.
So you come down on the side of everyone being heard.
Well, it's one of those things where it does end up. It's not like we live in a total anarchy. If we just have a general principle of hearing out everybody. As a practical matter, a lot of people won't be invited. A lot of people who don't have, you know, the credentials, who don't have strong scholarship behind them, will not be invited. But ultimately, like, Holocaust denial is always the nightmare scenario that is put up as, well, surely you don't believe that someone who believes in Holocaust denial should be invited to speak. And I think, in my opinion, is it's especially important that people who believe in Holocaust denial be invited to speak, and that you get to hear their views, because their views are preposterous. They can easily be defeated in argument. I mean, one of the main arguments was that it was essentially coincidental yellow fever. It's a terrible argument. Let that argument be heard, and it doesn't stand up to the light of day.
I want to come back to this question of the double standard. Thomas Lifson, is that something you agree with, that one of the things that universities seem to struggle with right now is a lack of consistency, that the same scrutiny isn't applied equally across the political spectrum?
Absolutely. That's my experience. It's the experience of most people that identify themselves as anywhere to the left or to the right of the absolute center post of American politics, that people on the left rarely, some exceptions, but rarely defend our rights to be heard. And on the other hand, when something like the Chemerinsky case comes along...
Hang on, Phil Zimbardo. Let Thomas Lifson finish, and then I'll come to you next.
When somebody like Chemerinsky comes along, I honestly didn't see really anybody on the right defending the decision to unhire him, and practically unanimous opinion that it was a horror for the chancellor of UCI to unhire him.
Let's come back to the Chemerinsky case, because we really haven't given that attention yet. But Phil Zimbardo, you were eager to make a point, and then we'll get on to the Chemerinsky situation.
No, I mean, talk about an outrageous statement to say people on the left don't want to endorse free speech on the campus. I mean, you know, let's just reject that as a ridiculous statement. I said from the beginning, and I consider myself a liberal with a capital L, that we welcome Rumsfeld coming in a context where he can talk, and we can discuss, we can debate. I have objected for the same reason when I was an assistant professor at NYU back in 1966. I objected to NYU giving an honorary degree to Robert McNamara, the architect of that war, when he said in his memoirs, "We knew the war was unwinnable, and we kept it going for 5 years with 20,000 American soldiers dead." I objected to giving him that honor, that distinction from the university, the same way I object to giving Rumsfeld this honorific position.
So your distinction, Professor Zimbardo, is you're welcome to speak, but we should not honor certain individuals.
That's right. For example, at Stanford some time ago, there was a Nobel Prize laureate, William Shockley, who was a scientist. He went around using the Stanford name to talk about why blacks are inferior to whites, using some outmoded psychological data which he did not understand. And because he was a Nobel laureate and it was Stanford University professor says, you know, blacks are inferior to whites, he got all the media attention. Well, I arranged a debate with a geneticist, Kavali Schwarzer, in which, you know, Shockley presented his views. And this geneticist just shot it down, saying these are ridiculous views. There's no solid evidence for this, you know. So that's what I have done. I want those people to speak. But I don't want them to use the platform of the university to advance their ideas or to get rewarded.
Right.
You know, for in Rumsfeld's case, you know, he was the architect of the torture of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo.
Well,
that's not undistinguished. I didn't know what undistinguished is.
Well, let's pick up then, extrapolating from the Rumsfeld story, to this question of hiring, because in a sense, Don Rumsfeld has been hired by the Hoover Institution for a period of a year. That brings us to this curious saga of what happened to Edward Chemerinsky, a distinguished legal scholar, on the left side of the political spectrum, outspoken, someone who you often debate with on the radio, John Eastman, someone whose views are very different from yours, but I know who you felt would have been a fine, and now will be, now that he's been rehired again, a fine dean for the new law school at UC Irvine. What's going on when someone who is obviously distinguished, who people on both sides of the political aisle think is a fine fellow and a commendable choice as dean, what's going on when universities are afraid of making that kind of hire?
Well, first of all, a lot of speculation about where the pressure came from and what led Chancellor Drake to do this had been floated. Chancellor Drake himself has said that he did not get outside pressure, and that his explanation for this was he realized during the course of the discussion how political Irwin has been in his career, and I think was having second thoughts on whether Irwin could shift gears and move into a dean's role that required a really different way of approaching things. That doesn't mean that we as deans don't continue to speak out and participate in politics and scholarship, but it does mean that, you know, there's a little bit of a different balancing act. You're no longer going solo. Every time you speak, you are really in effect speaking on behalf of your institution, and if you've organized the institution properly, there's not a uniformity of view that you can speak on behalf of. And what Chancellor Drake said in his public statements was that he started realizing that maybe that was not the nice fit. Now, he and Irwin met for a weekend at Irwin's house in North Carolina, and I think got beyond that and resolved what I have known about Irwin for a long time, and that is he is open to discussing, not so much to being persuaded by, but to at least discussing with people of opposite views. And I'll give you two examples. At USC, where he was a longtime law professor, he was the faculty advisor for the Federalist Society student chapter. And then my own debates with him, which have now been running for over 7 years weekly in a national media outlet, over 200 stations. He had 25 years of national reputation before I even started teaching. He didn't need to do that, but it gave me a platform and a national reputation well in advance of what I would have accomplished on my own. And so I think Irwin will be a great dean for all of his students and faculty, and I think he will assemble a faculty that reflects a pretty broad ideological spectrum.
I guess what I want to try to understand, and Greg Lukianoff, why don't you give us your thoughts on this, and then we'll have to go to break, but what's going on in a university environment that makes someone like Edward Chemerinsky suspect, and is that a phenomenon that you're seeing on college campuses around the country?
Well, it definitely there's worrisome trends have been for decades to that people's ideology are extremely important to their ability to teach. You see this in, for example, Teachers College at Columbia has a requirement that they evaluate people's quote-unquote commitment to social justice to see if they can be effective teachers. And then they get very specific about exactly what that means. And increasingly on college campuses, we see this tendency for universities to believe that if you don't have correct interior beliefs, you can't be a good teacher. You can't be a good professor. Now, this is terrifying to those of us who believe in the right of private conscience, who believe in the idea that the university is not the final arbiter of truth, that just hands down truth and puts it into you. Now, I've seen this, and I will agree with some of the other commentators. I tend to see this coming from the other direction. I've seen so many cases where you are much more likely to get in trouble on the modern campus if you have a socially conservative point of view, if you have a religiously orthodox point of view, or if, well, boy, you make fun of, if you satirize in an un-PC way. Now, this case, one of the reasons why I think Irwin had so much support from the conservative community behind them was that it felt like this is an example, they could say, we've been making this argument for years.
I need to hold you there, Greg Lukianoff, because we're coming up on a break. We'll be back and we'll take your questions on this topic about whether or not you're free to speak on a university campus. More of that discussion in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, academic freedom, who's allowed to speak at a university campus given what has happened recently with the disinvitation to Larry Summers, the former Harvard president, at a UC Board of Regents dinner, and the specter of President Ahmadinejad of Iran speaking at Columbia University. But also, what considerations come into play when you are hiring someone, be that a dean of a law school, as in UC Irvine, or a visiting scholar, as in the Hoover Institution and Donald Rumsfeld? We welcome your participation, comments, questions on this topic. You can join us now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org. forum@kqed.org. Before the break, Greg Lugianoff was talking about whether or not there is more of a concern these days on university campuses about the kinds of things that go into hiring and promotion decisions. I want to hear your point of view about that, Phil Zimbardo, and then Thomas Lifson, on this question about whether or not there is sort of a cooling effect, if you will, at university campuses these days that let people be less ambitious about the sort of choices they make. Phil Zimbardo, what are you seeing, for example, on the Stanford campus? Are people worried about who they hire? Phil Zimbardo? We've lost him. Tom Lifson.
Yes, I think there is. After all, look at what happened to the president of Harvard. He got fired for raising a question, not even making a statement one side or another of the issue. And you find this, of course, all the time in the classroom, where there are, quite frankly, on most campuses, groups that are ready to protest at the drop of a hat anything that might suggest a politically incorrect opinion. People get into trouble for this. Look at, and most fundamentally, look at the radical imbalance in terms of the politics of people who populate most campuses. If you do a search on contributions to political candidates for any, practically any major university, you'll find that contributions to Democrats are roughly 9 times as great as contributions to Republicans. There's a vast imbalance that, if we were talking about racial or gender issues, would be prima facie evidence of discrimination.
Are there, John Eastman, concerns about funding here? As you were saying earlier, it's not Chancellor Drake at the University of California, Irvine, has not been very precise about what's gone on with his decision-making, his decision to hire, his decision to fire, his decision to rehire. So it's difficult. But it seems like at least there was some outpouring of concern from some conservatives in the Orange County area that perhaps affected him in some way. Are these concerns particularly prevalent in a day and age where universities worry constantly, especially public universities, but even private universities like yours worry constantly about where their money is coming from?
Well, I don't think those two reads of what happened are inconsistent. There may well not have been any pressure from the conservative donor base, and yet it may well have been something that Chancellor Drake had in mind.
Yeah.
And so, it's not like either one of those sides is not true. They could both be true. And quite frankly, there have been some incidents at UCI in the relatively recent past that have exposed at least some segments of that fact faculty down there to be fairly radical. The Palestinian question and the just vicious attacks on Israel, for example, that have occurred and made their way in the news. And so they walk a tightrope between a faculty like that on occasion, or student groups that protest, and a more conservative traditional donor base in the surrounding area. And most universities are dealing with this, oftentimes not the local donor base, but the alumni donor base, which tend to be of an older generation and are not quite as willing to embrace certain radical causes. And you see that erupt and bubble up every once in a while. And I think any chancellor needs to try and walk that line very carefully and deftly. And his fear was that naming someone like Irwin would make it more difficult for him to walk that line. I think he was wrong in that assessment, but I don't think it was inappropriate for a chancellor to consider those.
To have those
concerns. Where that consideration should have occurred, though, was long before you give a contract
right.
to somebody.
Right. Phil Zimbardo, I think we have you back. We were just raising the question about whether or not universities, to some extent, are losing a bit of courage, whether or not they're whether it's because of political pressure or funding concerns, that universities are a little less willing, a little more cautious about not about who they hire. What's your sense of that at Stanford?
Well, I think in general universities have become very conservative, partly because the student base is conservative, conservative in the sense that they are worried about getting jobs. Before, you know, years back, if you graduated from any good university, you were guaranteed a job. The only question was how good a job. Students are running scared. And the last thing they want is, you know, anything on their record that might, you know, get them, you know, not to get the best job, certainly if they're going into any professional schools or any profession. So when there were anti-war rallies back in 2003 at Stanford, at most there were 200 students involved and maybe a handful of faculty. But, you know, so there is a kind of chilling effect, but it's not a political one. It's really an economic one. I would just like to insert that, you know, I mentioned before that I'm a liberal. I've been one of the most popular teachers at Stanford for 40 years. I have classes up to 1,000, and my liberal views seep in. However, I have, in one of my classes, at the beginning of the class, something called open microphone, where I encourage students to come up and challenge anything I said, either the content or the substance or the style or any political political agenda. And students do, and we open a free debate. In addition, we have always have a course website where students who are shy, who wouldn't come up publicly, can criticize anything that I've done. That's what I feel is the open discourse.
And Thomas Lifson, what you're saying in part is you don't think there's enough of that give and take, or that conservative students, conservative faculty are welcome enough on the university campus?
Absolutely, yes. And I've spoken with many students at many campuses about their fears of being graded poorly because of their political views and their reluctance, indeed, their complete avoidance of letting their politics show in the classroom. I commend Professor Zimbardo for his open mic, but I would note that his open-mindedness does not extend to allowing Donald Rumsfeld a position on his campus for a year, wherein Professor Zimbardo might be able to debate him more than would be allowed in a 90-minute speech.
Well, I think he's in favor of an open mic. He's just not in favor of a year-long open mic. Let me get to our callers, though, because we have a number of people who are eager to join in this conversation, and we should get to them now, starting with Lake, who joins us in San Jose. Lake, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'd like to bring your attention to an organization called CampusWatch.org, which is run by a man called Daniel Pipes, who is the lead attack dog of the Zionist movement in America. And that organization has one singular mission, which is to suppress any critical discussion of Israel in American university campuses. And I'd like to present that as an example of outside influence that affects the inability that, or the ability of universities to discuss all points of view when it comes to affairs of national or international importance.
All right,
and
thanks.
I'll take my comments off.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks for the observation. Greg Lukianoff, are you familiar with that situation?
I am. I'm familiar with Daniel Pipes. Actually, my first time on TV was debating Daniel Pipes over the Samuel Alarian case. But one thing that I see going on there, and to my knowledge, what Campus Watch does is they publicize and reveal some of what they consider to be anti-Israel biases on certain campuses. And I've noticed this on a lot of college campuses. A lot of professors, including Professor Stanton, who pushed for the disinvite of Larry Summers at UC Irvine, seem to confuse being publicly criticized with being censored. That, yes, I think there is a lot greater scrutiny on higher education than there used to be. I think this is in a lot of ways a good thing, and that because of the increased flow of information and how quickly people can get information, things like the Shemerinsky case can be more quickly resolved, but also reports of abuses get around a lot more quickly. And I mean, before working at FIRE, I had no idea how bad the situation was on a lot of campuses, how easy it was if you make an un-PC fat joke, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be political, but if you do happen to criticize affirmative action, if you make a play that picks on the wrong people, how easily you can get in trouble. And it really was eye-opening for me.
And you say that as a liberal.
I'm politically liberal. I've never voted Republican in my life, and my background is the Environmenters Project and the ACLU of Northern California.
Yeah, interesting. Seth joins us next in San Francisco. Seth, go ahead.
Hi. I actually have a little instructive experience about being a liberal and having a truly right-wing teacher. I grew up in Las Vegas in the 50s to the 60s, and it was a very right-wing town. And my American history teacher was a member of the John Birch Society. He was also really committed to the process of open debate about any political subject. And a friend of mine and I were in the class, I think we were juniors, and we'd both grown up in FDR families. And the teacher would express his you know, pretty radically right-wing views, but we would constantly challenge him. And the class would join into the debates. And what I found was so interesting about him is that when we were right, he supported us. I mean, to the point where we would actually make bets for ice cream or pizza for the class. and when we were right, he paid up.
Yeah.
And we were right very often. That's what I really liked about having. He wasn't threatening. It wasn't threatening to my parents in any way. And I found him to be one. Well, look at it. That's 45 years later, and he's the one teacher from high school I still remember.
Right. Yeah. Seth, nice story. Thank you for sharing it with us. John Eastman, that's what ought to go on, right, in university campuses. And I guess the question is whether or not we're somehow less willing in our current time to have those sorts of exchanges.
Well, it is a wonderful example of what ought to go on. And quite frankly, I have seen liberal professors that would do the same thing. And I applaud Philip's open mic policy as well. What unfortunately is all too often the case is kind of a doctrinaire refusal to entertain that kind of discussion. Greg referred to earlier spoofs that, you know, kind of run afoul of political correctness. And one of the more clever ones in recent years is the critique of affirmative action that had been put on by various college Republican chapters with their affirmative action bake sales. A wonderful spoof on making an important point that was just shut down as a horrendous thing, ought not to be talked about at all, when in fact it was a wonderful way to engage a discussion about an important issue cleverly in the way that student groups would are often fond of doing, in a way that mixes a little bit of humor to try and get people to think seriously about an important issue. But that was just excoriated and shut down from campus to campus where they tried it. So, you know, I find more often than not the open mic policy that Phillips talks about, but rather a kind of a pervasive political correctness. It really does shut down the kind of discourse that we expect to see on our university campuses.
Phil Zimbardo, chime in on that, if you would, because it does seem that there are some topics that are often having to do with race in particular that are so sensitive that it's very difficult to do anything, especially something that might be viewed as poking fun.
Yeah, that's really just so difficult, you know, for the students in the class. I had a colleague who was a fine teacher. And one of the things, he used a lot of humor in his lectures. And some of the humor that he did was sexist about women's bodies. And kids would laugh. Until one day, a woman in the class didn't laugh, but she hissed. And in fact, women never laughed before, it was the guys. And once he heard that, you know, he stopped the class and he said, "What's wrong?" And she said, I think it's wrong for you to, you know, be slighting women in this way." It changed his behavior. He never did it again. Yeah. So students have power that they don't realize, that, you know, faculty get appointed, promoted based on student evaluations, that most universities take it seriously. That's one place that students can register their complaint. But they can send anonymous notes to the chairman of the department to say, this particular professor is using his platform to present liberal or fascist or extreme views, or is sexist or racist. And that's one of the things we have to do, is encourage students to use that power that they have.
A couple of emails coming in. Matt writes, "Donald Rumsfeld joining the Hoover Institution is a good thing. It helps the public understand how far-right and hawkish they really are." Dave writes, "The Hoover Institution at Stanford has the sworn mission of finding the causes of war so we may have peace. Who better to study that than Don Rumsfeld, who has been deeply involved in the group that started our most recent war?" And we have another caller who wants to join in on the Rumsfeld question in particular. Ken in Woodland joins us. Ken, you're on.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah, you know, what I really want to say is that we have to make a distinction always between true conservatives and the neoconservatives. I believe Donald Rumsfeld is not at all qualified for an academic position because his career has been based primarily on secrecy and deception. And in fact, it is so absurd how many times this administration has ridiculously claimed executive privilege or national security on basic information. This is totally contrary to what an academic mission is, a free exchange of ideas.
Ken, thank you. Thomas Lifson, take that on, because one of the challenges that have been brought up about Don Rumsfeld in particular is that he's not a scholar by trade. He's not an academic. He hasn't engaged in scholarly pursuit. And you heard Ken's additional objections that the way in which he's conducted his professional life isn't conducive to the academic pursuit.
Not a scholar. He's a practitioner and one that occupied one of the highest offices in the land, and therefore he has a lot to contribute, particularly in the atmosphere of give and take. If people are concerned about what they believe was his secrecy, after all, defense does involve certain secrets, but if people are concerned about that, then why not have him on campus for a year and ask him questions, get him in open forums, debate him. The interchange of ideas is the way to resolve these issues, not the silencing and the shunning of someone. This strikes me as an absolutely absurd position to take that identifies one's opponent as evil. We're not talking about Ahmadinejad, who wants to destroy the nation of Israel and expresses the opinion that the Holocaust never happened. We're talking about people that are on the American political spectrum with whom others disagree, and they wish to anathemize them.
Thomas Lifson is editor and publisher of The American Thinker. He joins us this hour along with Greg Lukianoff of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, Phil Zimbardo, professor emeritus of psychology at Stanford, and John Eastman, constitutional scholar and dean of the Chapman University School of Law. As we continue to pursue this topic about how or whether you can draw lines about who can speak on a university campus and who can be hired. George in Palo Alto joins us next. George, you're on.
Hi, I'm actually on faculty at Stanford, and I signed the petition, and I just want to kind of talk about my reasons why, and I think it has to do primarily with the fact that I think the supposed, you know, abuse of human rights that existed at Abu Ghraib and also the kind of disruption of rule of law at Guantanamo are my primary reasons, and I would support him speaking, but like Dr. Zimbardo, I believe that giving him a title at Stanford conveys a different message than allowing him to speak.
So it's really his behavior and, in your view, his culpability for Abu Ghraib in particular that disqualifies him from being a scholar for a year?
Precisely. I think if I am against the war, but if he had not done any of that and were invited, then I think it would be appropriate because he hadn't crossed the line into what I consider human rights abuses.
George, thanks for the call. John Eastman, why don't you respond to that observation?
You know, it's very convenient that we're all for open mics, but then we define what doesn't qualify in this way.
But let me interject for a moment, because I think George was fine with the open mic part. He's not fine with being hired for a year.
Well, but it's at Hoover, and it's Hoover's decision. What they continue to object to is Hoover's relationship with Stanford, which is a much broader question.
Right.
This is a perfect appointment for Hoover, and the notion that Don Rumsfeld, who prosecuted the folks as soon as he got wind of it, of what was going on in Abu Ghraib, is responsible for Abu Ghraib, is something that ought to get more serious discussion, including with somebody like Don Rumsfeld on as a distinguished visitor at Hoover. And it's more likely that while he's there, we're going to engage in a less one-sided discussion about what occurred there. I applaud Hoover for this, and I think that, you know, if we're going to talk about open mic and beyond that, this is exactly the kind of thing that ought not to get shut down.
Yeah, Phil Zimbardo, we have to pause for just a moment, but just a fairly quick thought, if you would, please, on why not have a more extended conversation. I know you support the idea of Donald Rumsfeld speaking at Stanford, but for all the reasons that people have talked about in this program, for all of the controversies that he's been associated with, why not take this as an opportunity to have a kind of extended dialogue about that on a prestigious university campus?
I applaud that. I would be happy if they just did one thing, deleted the word distinguished, that he's just a visiting fellow. I mean, that's what I said from the beginning. It's the same argument I made 40 years ago about why NYU should not have given an honorary degree to McNamara, that what they have done is not distinguished. And so, yeah, have him on the campus, have Hoover pay him, you know, whatever. By making him distinguished, you honor his career, and much of his career has, in recent years, has been dishonorable from my point of view and from a lot of people's point of view. So it's not silencing him in any way. It's not stifling. It's not McCarthyism. It's none of those things. Those are false straw men. We simply object to Hoover Institution under the rubric of Stanford University giving him what's an honorific appointment.
Tom Lifson, do you buy that distinction, or is that too fine a line?
First of all, I think conflating an honorary degree, which is purely an honor, with a fellowship that carries the word distinguished in it is a little bit disingenuous, and I wonder if the professor at Stanford objects to Angela Davis's title at UC Santa Cruz. To remember the exact wording, but it includes terms like distinguished and university professor. This, after all, is a woman who was involved with a murderous group that kidnapped and executed a judge in Marin County, and was a member of the Communist Party.
We're going to hold our conversation for just a moment because, as our listeners are no doubt aware, this is Pledge Time on Public Radio, a time when we ask our listeners for their support. So for those of you who are listening right now on KQED in San Francisco and KQEI in Sacramento, you're going to be hearing a pledge break coming up in just a moment. But we do ask that our listeners on the Sirius Satellite Network, as well as our callers, stay with us because we will be continuing our conversation for the next few moments. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. And rejoining our phone callers now, Peter joins us next in Miami, Florida. Peter, you're on.
Hey, how you guys doing? Thank you for taking my call. My question is, after hearing the debate that you've had going back and forth, is how your guests and callers feel about future President Ron Paul. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Peter, I'm not entirely sure where to go with that question, but Greg Lukianoff, since I haven't heard from him in a while, you get to answer.
I'd like to answer that by not endorsing a candidate and just adding something on something that had been previously said.
Go ahead.
Now, I do think there's a major distinction between giving someone an award and having them come as a professor, and the interesting thing is what exactly this appointment to Hoover actually is. Now, when it comes to giving an award, awards are, of course, entirely subjective. They can be made for good or bad reasons, and it's utterly up to the institution whether or not they should give that award. And it's absolutely within people's right to say, wow, that was a really stupid choice for that award. But when it comes to professors, one of the things that I've seen, and I'm amazed that people fall for this trick, and when it comes to different kinds of speech, an argument that I've heard a lot in the past few years is that by having a professor there or by having an opinion posted in a newspaper, that's the same thing as endorsing the point of view of that paper, that cartoon, that professor. And the thing is, I don't really think that intellectually a lot of people actually believe this argument when they're making it. It's just the sort of convenient argument du jour to say, you know, this person's opinion really bothers me. I want to come up with an excuse. And that's the thing, is they tend to find out who they want to silence and then work backwards. I'm not saying that's what Philip is doing. I absolutely am not saying that's what Philip is doing. But I'm saying that I have run into this very often, particularly when it came to the Muhammad cartoons. Muhammad cartoons are arguably the most, when it comes to, cartoons don't usually create history. But over 50 people in the world died because of the publication of these cartoons. I thought it was insane that people would be making the argument that we couldn't show the cartoons because that would be the same thing as endorsing their message, when nobody reads a newspaper and assumes that the New York Times agrees with every single op-ed that's printed on its paper. So I find this argument very troubling, and it tends to come up when, for example, Samuel Arian was giving his anti-Israel points of view. The university tried to argue that, well, he was representing the university when he said that, and that's not the university's point of view.
Yeah. I want to come back to this question of what you were saying a moment ago, Greg Lukianoff, about points of view that make us uncomfortable, and return, because we haven't talked about this since the beginning of the program, about the situation with Larry Summers, the former president of Harvard, former Clinton Treasury Secretary, who was disinvited from a University of California Board of Regents dinner. seemingly because his past comments about whether or not researchers should probe gender differences in the brain between men and women and how that affected their scientific pursuits was deemed offensive. What's going on with that, John Eastman? And how do you draw a distinction between our lack of comfort with hearing those sorts of points of view?
Well, the notion that free speech also includes a collateral right not to be offended by somebody else's speech, I think, is one of the great losses in our understanding of the First Amendment. The Supreme Court used to say that the right is there to protect speech precisely because it is controversial, mm-hmm. because it is confrontational, because it forces you to think. However, are we going to move beyond the status quo if it becomes impossible to address things that are a little bit outside the box, and make some people that have grown accustomed to the status quo be comfortable, and I'll go back to the Don Rumsfeld thing on distinguished. I mean, my God, the guy's been Secretary of Defense. He's had a truly distinguished career. Even if some people like Philip think that it's been wrong-headed, it's entirely appropriate. And so, what's odd about this is that we would define the political views that are acceptable in opposition to even the use of the word distinguished, and then at the same breath claim that we are completely willing to engage all views. That I think is what you see infecting this discussion, and it happens on campus after campus after campus.
We just have a moment for a couple of quick, very quick last thoughts as to how you think universities should be guided as they struggle with this issue. See if we can get around once, but only about 10 seconds each, please. Phil Zimbardo first.
Yeah, the Larry Summers thing is similar to what I said about William Shockley. It was because he was the president of Harvard, made statements that he should have made to the faculty. If he believed there should have been research, he should have arranged for a research grant. Because he's president of Harvard, it made national media that the president of Harvard is questioning whether women have some innate difference that makes them less likely to do well in math and science. That was misusing his position.
Yeah, interesting.
And that's the same as Shockley talking about blacks being inferior.
Tom Lifson, last quick thought.
Professor Summer, or President Summers raised that question in a private seminar. He wasn't attempting to bring it onto the national stage. That was the feminists who made an issue of it and brought it to public attention. I think universities have to err on the side of allowing points of view to be expressed, and I abhor attempting to shut people down because of the content of their speech.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to shut our program down. Greg Lukianoff, apologies for not getting a last word from you. Thanks to all of you, John Eastman, Phil Zimbardo, Thomas Lifson, and Greg Lukianoff, for participating in our open mic conversation about what can be said and what can't be on university campuses today. Forum is produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineer, Danny Bringer. And the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.